Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, so that means my dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Every Monday, my dad calls in, tells a joke. Let's start our work week with a laugh. And also, the Monday morning movie reviews will be happening. Colin Suter, again, off for a couple of months, so Jim Leskowski will be filling in, our good friend Jim. So Jim and Eric Childress will be joining me to review all the new movies. And Eric and I will also discuss the box office movies for this weekend. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Later on, we're going to be talking about biopics, good, bad, and good and bad. That'll be coming up a little bit later on in honor of Bohemian Rhapsody, which was released this weekend. All right. So that's all coming up on the show. Again, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Let me say hello to my great producer, Dan Shugru. Hi, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you, sir?
Good, man. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Do you have a good weekend?
Yeah, it was a very nice weekend.
Some birthday parties?
Yeah,
right?
Three birthday parties, so it was a lot of fun. So.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah.
Okay. November birthdays. You're one of them.
I am, yeah.
Vic Vaughn, who's out this morning, he's also one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So November birthdays all over the place. And in for Vic Vaughn in the newsroom is Jen DeSalvo. Hi,
well,
Jen.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Is Vic celebrating his birthday today?
No, he is. His son, he took the morning off because last night there was an awards ceremony for the football team that his son is on. And evidently, he scored a touchdown in every. He's a wide receiver. He scored a touchdown in every game this season.
What?
And he's getting a special award for having a great season.
Oh my gosh, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and he's moving on to varsity. I guess he's a sophomore, and I guess he's moving on to varsity next season. And he's very excited about it. So Vic took the night off to celebrate with his son. So
aww.
Yeah,
well deserved.
Yeah. So Jen is here. She'll be here until 5 a.m. And there you go. Did you have a good weekend?
I did.
Yeah.
I love that extra hour of sleep. Always very helpful.
Yeah, it is. It's yeah. Back when I was a drinking man, it was the extra hour of drinking.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's now it is indeed the extra hour of sleep. Now that's that.
Yeah, or bartending. I used to bartend.
Me too.
Yeah, and they'd be like, "Oh, we'll keep the bar open an extra hour," and it's like, "No, these people do not need more alcohol." Yeah.
You know, what's funny is I was just talking. We were talking about this last week because I used to do Saturday overnights here on WGN before I got the full time gig on weekdays.
Mm-hmm.
So I did Saturday, and I can't tell you the number of times that I've been on either with the extra hour. I'd have to do an extra hour, so I'd instead of a 5-hour show, I'd have to do a 6-hour show.
Oh yeah!
And between 2 and 3, and then the second time, no spots because they would not sell ads for an hour that actually technically didn't exist. So
oh,
I would have to do an extra hour of radio with like no commercials, and that would happen, and then we would lose an hour in the spring.
It's difficult to talk for a straight hour.
It certainly is. Let me tell you. So, well, not so much for me because I blab like an idiot. But all right. So there's Jen. She's in the newsroom. Dan is producing, and I am here as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the guys are going to be here to talk about all the new movies. Lots of new movies to talk about this week, and we'll get Jim and Eric's thoughts on those movies right after we take a break. Here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. And it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And coming up in just a couple seconds here, we've got the Monday morning movie reviews. Colin Suter is taking a little time off. He's doing some school stuff. So Jim Leskowski is going to be filling in for him for the next couple of months. So that's who's going to be with us. It'll be Jim and Eric to review all the new movies. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And we're going to be talking about biopics a little bit later on and as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right, let's get right to it. We got some movies to talk about and the box office. Eric will stick around and we'll talk box office. Some interesting numbers about that coming out as well. So let's get to welcoming these guys. Here's Eric. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. We got some movies to get to. So why don't we start with Eric. Why don't you tell us about Bodied?
Okay, Bodied is a film that premiered at the Toronto Film Festival in 2017 and became a little bit of an instant sensation on the festival scene. Everywhere it seemed to play, it kind of popped up at Sundance. Everyone who went in and came out of the thing talked about, you know, just what an unbelievably energetic, lively film this was, so much so that we ended up programming it at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and it's the story of a young college student who's doing a thesis on rap battles. So as the film opens, he and his very disapproving girlfriend go to sort of witness a rap battle and want to learn more about it from one of the sort of the rising stars, or one of the current stars on the rap battle scene, if you will, a character known as Ben Grimm, spelled differently than the Fantastic Four character, of course. So they end up sort of forming a bit of a friendship when the kid seems to know what he's actually talking about, and actually turns into kind of a bit of a good rapper himself. So they end up sort of touring around, going to different places where rap battles take place, and all of a sudden this kid finds himself participating in them themselves, and just becoming a bit of a rising, unexpected star himself. The thing is that one thing, if you've ever seen rap battles, they don't turn out to be the most politically correct of things. And so this is a movie that then begins to explore the very nature of political correctness as seen through the eyes of different races and cultures and lifestyles and things, classes. And it's a film that is so energetic. It is so full of just these lively rap battles. And you know, when I talk about rap battles, I mean that's not a term that flows frequently off my tongue. It's not something that I'm particularly have a great interest in. I was not a fan of 8 Mile, and I'm not really astute in the rap world. But this is a film that has something much larger to say than just giving us, you know, these wonderful exchanges, you know, between these contestants. They're really trying to get at something here about what exactly our culture has been going through, you know, particularly recently. But you know, you see the seeds of it. The things that we have been going through for so long, just the nature of how far we can go with our speech, you know, where does someone cross the line? And it's a film that has shifting loyalties to it. The main character is one that we, you know, at one point we're rooting for, and the other point we are entirely rooting against. It is sort of the disintegration of this character, not because of the culture that he ends up investing himself in, but just the nature of humanity, that, you know, we're predisposed to go down these routes if we don't learn, you know, exactly the history from where these horrible phrases and things come from. And it's like I said, I mean, this is as lively a movie as you're going to see this year. It is incredibly funny at times. It is meant to make you uncomfortable, and gloriously so. And it really is, when I walk out of this thing, I never expected a movie about rap battles to be one of my favorite movies of the year, but Bodied absolutely is.
Wow, okay. That's playing at the River East exclusively, if you want to see it. It's at the River East downtown. So, okay, that's Bodied. All right. Jim, why don't you tell us about Wildlife?
Happy to. Yeah, since it's become reviewing a lot of movies that are written and directed by actors, because not only is this Paul Dano's directorial debut, but he has also co-written the script with Zoe Kazan, and it's been adapted from a book by author Richard Ford. It's set in the 1960s, and it tells the story of a family in Montana. We mainly view the world through the eyes of young Joe, and he is about 14 or so, a little bit reserved, but also a good student and is encouraged to achieve more by his parents. Father is played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and mother, Jean, is played by Carey Mulligan. So when Jerry is fired from his job at the golf course, he sort of spirals into a little bit of a midlife crisis or even a mild depression of sorts, which brings out the cracks, I guess, in the already sort of vulnerable marriage that the two are experiencing. And then he has, on top of it, dwindling finances. So Jean is forced to take up teaching swimming classes at the Y, and son Joe decides to pitch in by taking a part-time job with a photographer. Ultimately, Jerry decides to go and fight wildfires near the Canadian border to instill some sense of purpose in his own life, which leaves Jean quite distraught at the thought of being alone. And so then Joe has to go out and, you know, take care of his own personal life out there in the wild. And then mother is, sort of struggling and impulsively, but understandably, is driven to another man, played by character actor Bill Camp, as she sort of strives to break free of her roles as mother and wife. And then we witness the effects of family strife and fragility, with each person coping differently as things begin to spiral out of control. So will this family be able to work out things, and does Jean need to move forward, and how will son Joe sort of cope with all this is kind of what we get to experience here. So, yeah, as I mentioned at the top, that last week we reviewed mid-90s, which I wasn't crazy about, as well as What They Had, both of which were written and directed by actors, and it seems like that's kind of happening a lot lately, and this is one of the better examples, wildlife here. So I think the appeal of a lot of these films is watching these incredible actors portraying very, very memorable characters. And obviously domestic dramas like this in particular are kind of a dime a dozen. So something like this really needs to sort of stand out to distinguish itself from other films about rocky marriages. But this is one of them. And the actors here sort of just disappear into their roles and keep you invested in their characters. I know some audience members at early screening sort of viewed Carey Mulligan's character as Jean as kind of like this hopelessly cruel and selfish character, but I didn't have that experience. I mean, I think the screenplay showcases a lot of dimension to her. She makes choices and makes mistakes like real people, and she certainly makes some rash decisions and potentially damaging choices, but at the same time, I think, you know, she means well, and she's trying to at least become a fully realized individual while also trying to be, you know, supportive for her son. And I think we have a lot of sympathy for her, and you know, I just think someone like Carey Mulligan keeps her grounded and very sympathetic. I think this might be Carey Mulligan's best role since maybe her first with an education. And Dano here, I mean, he shows a lot of restraint and sensitivity in his debut. And it's clear that, you know, working with a lot of our very best directors, he's learned a lot. Since cinematography is great, there are some really photogenic, gorgeous shots capturing a part of the country we don't normally get to see, and the men here are very well observed as well. So I think this is a great film. It's more for the performances than anything else, but I think it's very special. And this one gets a high recommendation, and I hope Mulligan gets some well-deserved awards attention at the end of the year because it's quite good.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up here, and then when we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought of Wildlife, and then I'll tell you what I thought of Wildlife as well. Monday morning movie reviews will continue right after the news, which is next on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, here till 5 a.m. I'm here, I'm your overnight dude, weekday mornings, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And for talk and text, we got a bunch of stuff we're going to be talking about. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning. And in honor of Bohemian Rhapsody being released, we are going to talk about biopics, some of the best and maybe some of the worst. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And there you go. We are reviewing the new movies as we do every week. Jim Laskowski is filling in for Colin Suter for a while. And Eric Childress is here. They're both here and we're in the middle of reviewing movies. And then after we finish the reviews, Eric and I will talk about the box office results for the weekend. So let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. Eric, you tell us what you thought of Wildlife.
Yeah, this was one of my very favorite movies from Sundance this year. And, you know, talking about an environment that, you know, Jim sort of hinted at, that the idea that, you know, these movies might seem like a dime a dozen, that certainly can be true at Sundance. But, you know, Paul Dano does some remarkable things with this film, not the least of which is its casting. I echo Jim's sentiments that I think this is Carey Mulligan's best performance to date. And that's saying something. I mean, you mentioned An Education, which was, I also saw at Sundance, and that was sort of her breakthrough role. But, you know, this is such a rich character. And you see, like, her entire history of this character in her face at times throughout this movie. You know, people want to deem her a selfish character. That's fine, I suppose. But I think that this is a character that is exploring the opportunity to be selfish for the first time in her life. And you know, there's some movies that, you know, gain a greater power because of the time in which they are born in. And, you know, Zoe Kazan obviously is a very, very voiceful activist out there. And this is a movie, you know, about a woman in a particular time. Not to say that Jake Gyllenhaal's character is not sympathetic. He is throughout the movie. But, you know, you question her decisions at times, but you never, at no point do you ever feel distanced from her. You know, you want, you know, the best for this family. And, you know, not a lot is being said about Ed Oxenbold, who plays the boy in the film. I think he gives a wonderful performance, you know, right up to, you know, the sort of the discoveries that he's making in his own life, and up to, I think, the kind of the perfect final moment of this film. It's a movie that I haven't seen since Sundance. I'm very much looking forward to revisiting this before we start filling out our ballots. But I'm pretty sure Carey Mulligan is going to be on mine, and other areas on my ballot might be filled by this movie as well.
Yeah, this is great stuff, man. Great stuff, and a really, really strong debut as a director from Dano. The three of us could just sit here and talk about Carey Mulligan all morning. Seriously, because she's astonishing in this movie, and she's such a great actress. And again, Eric, I agree with you. I think it's the best role she's ever had, and that's saying a lot because she's been great in a lot of great movies. But this is a really amazing performance. All the performances are good. I'm glad you mentioned the kid too, because he's very good as well. I cared about the characters, but Jake Gyllenhaal is you know, usually very, very good, and it's a really interesting and complex role here. And you know, the whole like marriage in trouble thing has been done a million times, as we've mentioned before. And I think that this movie has a lot of power to it, and I think is, as you said, Eric, is released at a pretty important time for a movie about like about this subject matter. But I think Dano makes a great directorial debut. I thought the screenplay adaptation by him and Zoe Kazan is really wonderful and complex and interesting, and you know, the cast here is just superlative. I mean, it's a joy to watch these people act, with such strong material, and in particular, Carey Mulligan. I think she has to be nominated for an Academy Award for this role. She must. I mean, is she a favorite, Eric, you think?
I don't know. I haven't examined the race too closely yet, and you know, I mean, IFC is releasing this movie, and yeah, they've been able to get some people in. I mean, Boyhood was a big success for them, some years ago.
Yeah.
But these independent studios like IFC and Magnolia. I mean, look how hard we were campaigning for Harry Dean Stanton last year for Lucky.
Yeah.
And Magnolia, didn't even make a ripple. Last year, I think there'll be more calls for Carey Mulligan this season, and I think you will see her name pop up in some critics' awards and nominations and things like that. And hopefully, that will translate to something. So, I mean, if the critics keep her name in the conversation, then she has a legitimate shot.
Well, I'll be keeping her name in the conversation. I can tell you that right now,
so will I.
Because it's one
absolutely.
Of my favorite performances of the year, and she is. She's just great in it. I mean, really, really mm-hmm. great. And it's a really, really strong film. So all the way around, man, I think this is a terrific piece of work. And I'm really happy for Paul Dano. He's a guy I like, as an actor.
Yeah.
And now I like him as a director. So nice job all the way around. And again, Carey Mulligan, amazing. So that's Wildlife. Three strong, very strong yeses for Wildlife. So there you go. All right. Now, by the way, none of us saw the Tyler Perry movie. called Nobody's Fool with Tiffany Haddish. We'll talk.
When he starts screening them for critics, I'll start going to see him.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in the box office coming up a little bit later on. Eric, you actually did go see The Nutcracker in the Four Realms.
Yeah.
Is it as good as the Andrei Konchalovsky masterpiece from a few years ago?
Well, I mean, define good. when you bring up that film, you have to qualify it with why we're fascinated with that movie. Because I was at an event last night where someone said this one is actually way worse than that version. I think that's a bit of an overreach. If I may say so, but at the same time, I would rather watch the Andrei Konchalovsky version because
oh, wow.
It is so insane and so wrong and so bad and such a unbelievable failure. The Nutcracker in the Four Realms is Disney's new version of their reimagining or whatever it might be of the Nutcracker ballet. And it basically, it's Disney, basically doing it in the Alice in Wonderland, Alice through the Looking Glass, Oz the Great and Powerful, milieu. This is a movie that, the young girl played by Mackenzie Foy, who, played Matthew McConaughey's daughter in Interstellar.
Right.
Okay, so, high praise already there. And she stars as a girl who gets a present from her late mother on, I think it's Christmas, I guess. And it's just like this golden egg, and it has to be opened. She doesn't know how to open it. Thankfully, her godfather is played by Morgan Freeman, and he's an inventor and a locksmith and stuff, and he's got the necessary key. She gets transported to the world of the Sugar Plum Fairies, played by Keira Knightley, and Mother Ginger or whatever, played by Helen Mirren. And it's just it's another story of a girl transported to a magical land and has to be the savior of the magical land from the people who are trying to overtake it. So it's just and that's about the best thing I can say about this movie is that I was just absolutely disinterested in it. If ever a movie is just constantly leaning on its costumes and art direction and occasional special effects to tell its story, it's this one, because there's nothing involving about this at all. I mean, it's funny enough, it's the second movie this week that we're going to be talking about where the familiar themes in the soundtrack transport you to better times. you know, hearing, you know, bits and pieces of the Nutcracker Suite and, you know, the, all the famous chords that we're familiar with in that ballet, you know, it kind of takes us back to whether it be, you know, Fantasia or Caddyshack or whatever it might be. It takes you to another place. It's just like, okay, I like this. Let's stick with this. And there's like, no, it's just we're going to have, you know, little CGI mice and, you know, soldiers and Keira Knightley, you know, doing Dark Crystal stuff. I don't know. It just, I sat there with this kind of glazed expression, I think. If someone was, there was a camera on me, I don't know if I ever changed my expression. I just sat there just kind of like squinting at it. And, like, what am I supposed to care about here, precisely? Because I don't even know if the movie really does. And it's kind of, it's kind of indistinguishable from those other movies, except that, like, Sam Raimi and Tim Burton would occasionally make you feel like they cared about the material a little bit. I mean, I think Alice in Wonderland is, you know, maybe Tim Burton's worst film, maybe. But, you know, at least Sam Raimi with Oz the Great and Powerful, you know, had some images and some sequences and got performances that, you know, at least kind of kept you in the game. This one has nothing to keep you in the game. It's just a series of sets and costumes and occasional special effects that is just not worthy of anyone's time. You're better off just listening to an album of the Nutcracker.
I happen to be a huge fan of Oz the Great and Powerful. I know you guys know that. I just think it's a great film. I'm interested in the directing credits here. Is there a behind the scenes story as to why it's credited to both Lasse Hallström and three-star Joe Johnston?
Yes, there is actually. Lasse Hallström was the original director on the film, and he completed it, and then they wanted to do special effects reshoots, and he was not available to do it. So they brought in Joe Johnston to do like a month's worth of reshoots. I mean, this movie was like initial principal photography was like finished in like 2016.
Wow.
So it's kind of been sitting out there for a while, and then Joe Johnston came in and did the month's worth of reshoots or whatever, and then they like mutually agreed to share credit on the film.
Oh, okay.
But either of them was indistinguishable.
Yeah. I mean, I knew there had to be a reason why Lasse Hallström is not the only credited director on this movie.
It shares many things in common with a movie we're going to be reviewing in a little while.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. And by the way, you know, I think it's pretty cool that, and it says something about Christopher Nolan's casting of children, because these two kids that play that play McConaughey's, you know, kids in Interstellar have gone on to some pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank Christopher Nolan for casting those two kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the other one who the other one is going to get, I think, nominated again this year for Best Actor.
It's very possible.
Yeah. So, all right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jim and Eric are here. We got a couple more movies to review, and the Monday morning movie reviews will continue after this right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18th floor of the beautiful 303 East Wacker here on WGN. And it is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call up and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time every Monday morning. And we're going to talk about biopics. That's all coming up. At 5 o'clock, you got Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And coming up, Steve Cochran at 6. And coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. So that's all coming up here. And let's get back to the movies. Jim Laskowski is filling in for Colin Suter, as he will for the next few weeks. And Eric Childress are here, and we're talking about movies. And we'll get to the box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello again.
All right. Jim, tell us about Bohemian Rhapsody.
Wow, I've never heard of this movie. Nobody is talking about it at all on social media in any way, especially on Facebook. But yeah, well, I think most folks out there probably can guess as to the plot of this particular biopic, even if it takes some liberties with the real life story. It's kind of a tilt-a-whirl tour through Mercury's rise and tragic end. And we briefly start at the 1985 Live Aid performance, only to go back to the beginning. We first meet young Freddie when he was known initially as Farouk, played by Rami Malek. He's the son of immigrants, and we first see him as he's working as a baggage handler at Heathrow Airport, kind of writing songs on the fly on his notepad and, as a solo piano artist initially, and then eventually makes some pilgrimages out to a local club to hear his favorite band, Smile. And when that group's lead singer quits, he decides to hold his own impromptu audition in the parking lot, wowing guitarist Brian May and drummer Roger Taylor with his soaring range and uncanny ability to sort of project these incredible falsettos and gorgeous notes and harmonize instantly with his new friends in the moment there in the parking lot. And meanwhile, Freddie also meets and ultimately proposes to the love of his life, Mary Austin, here played by Lucy Boynton. And, you know, even though deep in their hearts, they know that Freddie is struggling with his own sexual identity, even if it's kind of addressed here almost as like Cliff's Notes, we sort of watch the usual rise and fall. This is kind of a biopic with a capital B, and doesn't necessarily transcend beyond that. Obviously, the story has parallels to other music biopics, maybe because so many famous musicians' lives sort of follow this path. They start out struggling, they find true love, and then artistic success, struggles with stardom and touring, gets involved with drugs, losing your sense of self, growing apart from those who are close to you, and then ultimately making a comeback before a tragic end. So if we've learned anything from the clever and satirical Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, these tropes have kind of been done over and over and over again. And obviously, a story like Freddie Mercury's is absolutely worth telling in of itself. It's ripe for some kind of grand cinematic achievement. But unfortunately, here, with Bohemian Rhapsody, it follows a formula, and one that was, you know, skewered a decade ago in Walk Hard. Like, you would hope for maybe something on the level of something like Amadeus. But, again, this is a movie that is very predictable and safe, and Freddie Mercury's life was not predictable. So important moments are kind of, like, sketched out like bullet points here and are dramatized with kind of, like, this sense of duty from initially the director was Bryan Singer until he was fired from the production, at which point Dexter Fletcher stepped in to finish filming, but Bryan Singer is credited here. It's just the script has just completely embraced conventions and cliches as almost just crowd-pleasing elements. The only bright spot here really is Rami Malek's commitment and energy to the role of Freddie Mercury. I think he does a great job. And certainly the exuberant Live Aid show, which lasted 20 minutes in real life and made history, it's obviously the highlight also towards the end. So that part of it in of itself is impressive and kind of worth the wait. But really, it's kind of sad how forgettable this movie ends up being. I mean, there's a cameo by a particular actor as he listens to Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time that was more distracting and silly for me. And sitting through this it becomes kind of a chore. I felt it was like really over edited and rushed to get to certain moments. And I just don't think the filmmakers knew how to sort of encompass and encapsulate such a monumental talent. And I felt really, really restless while watching it because I knew deep down there could have been a much, much better take on this story. I even think like somebody like Edgar Wright might have been able to do this story justice in a more interesting way. So this is a subpar example of a music biopic. I cannot recommend this one, which is a huge, huge shame. Outside of Rami Malek, there is very little here to praise.
Okay. Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And when we come back, we'll come back. We'll find out what Eric thought of Bohemian Rhapsody and then what I thought of Bohemian Rhapsody right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on a Monday morning here till 5 a.m. My dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday, and he'll be calling in with a joke a little later on in the show. We are also going to be talking about biopics and more. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Here till 5 a.m., and Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on this Monday morning to get your work week started. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're in the middle of the movie reviews. Before the break, Jim Leskowski told us what he thought of Bohemian Rhapsody and didn't like it and is not recommending it. Jim, welcome back. And Eric,
thank you much.
Back. All right, Eric.
Thank you.
Chime in on Bohemian Rhapsody.
Queen was the first band I ever loved. Mm-hmm. Still love them to this day. Yep. So this is a movie that I've been waiting more than 40 years for.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
I think you and I are going to have similar reviews here, Eric. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we may as well just talk together practically because I think we're on the same page on this one.
Yeah.
Because I hated this movie.
Yeah.
At parts during it, certainly afterwards, and even much more in the days since I've seen it. Jim touched. If this movie. If the worst thing you could say about this movie is that it followed the tropes that we are so familiar with in A Walk Hard, and I made Dewey Cox references in my notes when I was watching this movie.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been fine, I suppose, because at least then it would have just been on a level of a disappointment rather than an insult to the memory of Freddie Mercury. And part of that, I'm going to guess, is probably must be laid at the feet of Brian May, who was very much associated with this project, did not want Sacha Baron Cohen to do the sort of warts and all treatment that he wanted to do. And by warts and all, not that, I don't think Sacha Baron Cohen was going to insult Freddie Mercury's memory, but I think he wanted to tell the truth as much as he possibly could about a guy that, as many biographies have been written over the years, there really hasn't been anything I would call a definitive take on the life of Freddie Mercury or this band, for that matter. So it only just increases the level of hostility I have towards this movie. And it starts very early. The scene that Jim referenced about where Freddie Mercury first, tests his voice out in front of, May and Taylor, and just like, you hear, those falsettos, you hear how powerful that voice is, and this movie's not interested in tackling what sets Freddie Mercury apart from his contemporaries, why his contemporaries had such a high esteem for him. In this movie, they give him one line, and it's about his teeth. Because he has extra teeth in his mouth, he has a greater range. And they pinpoint it on that one line, and that's the last you hear about it for the rest of the movie. Then the movie wants to get into his sexuality. Now, there were rumors for a long time about the production of this movie that AIDS wasn't even going to be mentioned in this movie. And it seemed ridiculous at the time, but watching this movie, it almost feels like during the reshoots, during the Dexter Fletcher days, that the AIDS stuff almost seems to be inserted into it as to, like, oh, we heard the outrage, we better put this stuff in, otherwise it's going to feel, that someone convinced Brian May to put this stuff in. I don't know, I'm just speculating, I'm just ranting at this point. But the manner in which they deal with his sexuality, it didn't dawn on me immediately, but as the course of the movie went through, the movie takes the almost seems to be taking the position, whether intentionally or not, and I don't think it was intentional, but someone had to recognize that everything bad that happens to Freddie Mercury happens after he admits he's bisexual. And I think that it is so incredibly tone deaf. I mean, literally, the moment that he comes out to his the love of his life, and he says, I'm bisexual, and she goes, oh, so you're gay. Okay, so immediately you have that stigma attached to it. And then they fast forward 5 years, and he's got the short haircut and the famous mustache, and he asks Roger Taylor, what does he think? And Roger Taylor says, gayer. Okay, great. Now Another One Bites the Dust is an anthem for cruising during the AIDS crisis. That's what this movie, you know, suggests that that song is. It doesn't really get into meanings of lyrics. Take a breath, Eric.
I feel your pain, my friend.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. I'm gonna let you pick up where I leave off. But it's very easy for Nick and I, you know, off air, joked about how not so much joke, but joked a little bit about how they don't touch upon Queen's contributions to 80s cinema, particularly one
right.
great movie in 1980.
Yeah.
And then, that didn't bother me so much because I wasn't expecting that to be in the movie. Nor was I expecting there to be, you know, a great tribute to Iron Eagle, Highlander.
Right.
But this movie doesn't, it just seemed like this movie could have been better off just making a version of the rock opera that's on stage, because the way that they use the music in the movie, They made the movie around the music rather than make a movie about the music. You know, when they get to a very particular moment in Freddie Mercury, a turning point in Freddie Mercury's life, and they actually start playing Under Pressure on the soundtrack, I groaned so loud in the theater, I almost choked.
Yeah.
This is a disaster of a movie. People who associated with it, with the exception of Rami Malek, who, you know, I will back, you know, everyone saying how good he is in the movie and the commitment that he has to it. I think at times he does lean a little too much into his teeth at times. But when he's on stage, he provides the movie with an energy that Bryan Singer and Dexter Fletcher could not bring to any of the musical moments. The Live Aid performance at the end of the movie is all Malik, as far as I'm concerned, and the music. You know, anything that good happens in this movie is associated with the music. I felt really terrible leaving this movie.
Yeah. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I think it's an insult to the memory of Freddie Mercury. And completely. And I think, we're all saying that Rami Malek, he came to play. There's no question about it. He's got nothing to work with. Like, they gave him nothing to work with, but he is committed 1,000% to this role. And, you know, and there are times when he's really great. The last 15 minutes of the movie, he owns it. But everything leading up to that is, cliche after cliche after cliche. From, you know, the montage sequences, which are ridiculous, to whatever, you know, the up and down tragedy of being a rock star, whatever that is, they've made it as generic as you can possibly make it. And what's really aggravating is that, Freddie Mercury was as far from generic as anyone has ever been. But they turned his life into like an ABC movie of the week, and not even that good. So just on that level, it's bad. This movie has so many ridiculous inaccuracies throughout it that I just kept getting angry while I was watching it. I'm like, that never happened. This never happened. The timeline is all screwed up. At one point in the movie, they say that they're going on their first tour and they play Fat Bottom Girls, which was not recorded until like 12 years later. And I don't even want to talk about the timeline in terms of when they were making what. The producer that worked with them, Roy Thomas, who produced a lot of their records, including Night at the Opera. When they're recording Bohemian Rhapsody, he's just reduced to some idiot sitting next to Freddie Mercury, like not even pressing buttons. And this guy's one of the greatest music producers of all time. They got a guy who played in Kenny Everett, which I thought was kind of my favorite moment in the movie was they actually did have a reference to Kenny Everett. People might not know who Kenny Everett is, but he was a DJ who first played Queen. But he also had a comedy show called The Kenny Everett Show, which I loved and was on in the late 70s. But there's a scene with him. I'm like, oh, they got a guy playing Kenny Everett. I don't know. But here's another thing. I mean, I could just go on and on about how horrible this movie is. There is lie after lie after lie. All right. First of all, Deacon and Taylor released solo albums before Freddie Mercury did.
Mm-hmm.
He was not kicked out of the band because he wanted to go solo. That's not what happened. He never had to put a tail between his legs and go back and beg for the band to take him back. And then the most unforgivable thing about this movie, there are so many things that are unforgivable about it, is the way that they actually use the AIDS, how he contracted HIV. First of all, he tells them while they're rehearsing for Live Aid, okay? They're rehearsing for Live Aid, and his voice isn't up to par. They've graciously allowed Freddie to come back into the band. Oh, God. And then, so they're rehearsing, and he tells them that he's got it, which is the line that he actually uses in the movie, which my mind was almost blown. So they tell him, now here's the, in real life, Freddie Mercury was diagnosed with HIV in 1987. That's 2 years after Live Aid. According to this movie, to amp up the emotion and to get him to be accepted back into the band, they say that he was diagnosed before Live Aid. That's a lie. That's absolutely a lie. And the reason why it makes me so mad is because it's this cheap way to get emotion for the last 15 minutes of the movie when you don't need that, because that performance alone is one of the greatest performances in the history of rock. One of the greatest live performances ever in the history of rock and roll. And you do not need to amp it up with a lie about when he contracted HIV. It's a bunch of crap, and it's not fair. There's so many other things in this movie that just don't make any sense. That never happened. I mean, I just can't even. And the whole Mike Myers thing is one of the most ridiculous things, and he's like the part that Mike Myers plays is not a real guy. He's a combination of like three or four different suits. So they cast him as stunt casting so that he can insult Bohemian Rhapsody and actually say, no kids would drive around in their car and bang their heads to this song. Oh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. So, now, here's the other thing. Now, granted, the last 15 minutes of the movie, obviously you can't argue the music. The music is Queen. They're awesome. Mm-hmm. So the best part of this movie is the music. There's no question about that. And the last 15 minutes is very impressive on how they reenacted that. And Malick is fabulous during the last 15 minutes of the movie. So, it's a cheap way to get everybody, and then you see Freddie at the end. They show like real footage of Freddie. So you can walk out in a good mood because the last 15 minutes is just basically a recreation of the Live Aid performance. And then you get to see real footage of Freddie. So that's nice, but you've sat through 2 hours of crap leading up to that. And also, they recreate the Live Aid footage, which is the best thing in the movie. But here's the deal. You can go to YouTube right now and watch that. So I suggest skipping this piece of crap movie. And don't listen to the lies and the inconsistencies and the inaccuracies. Just go to YouTube and watch the 20-minute performance from Live Aid. That's all you need to do. I hated this movie. Hated it. So
my one-sentence review when people first asked me after I'd seen the movie what I thought about it, I said there's nothing you can get out of this movie that you couldn't get by listening to 2 hours of Queen on your iPod.
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
A disaster.
Well, I thought it was a pretty bad movie, but listening to you guys talk about it further, I think it is terrible.
Well, I mean, it's unforgivable.
More thinking about
in terms of what, the license that they took with this guy's life and the timeline and the inaccuracies, there's no, you can't defend that. You can't defend it. It's an awful movie. All right, guys, hang on. I got to calm down.
Yeah, me too.
All right, we'll take a break.
Take a breath.
take a break here, and we'll come back. And we got another movie to review before we do that. So welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. We are reviewing the new movies. Eric Childress and in for Colin Suter is Jim Liskowski. We thank him for sitting in. And let's get the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jim, welcome back.
And thank you.
All right. Eric, care to take a crack at describing Suspiria for everybody?
Oh, man. How'd I get stuck with doing this one? Oh, man. Okay. Well, this is the Luca Guadagnino did Call Me By Your Name. This is his remake or reimagining, however you want to call it, of Dario Argento's classic cult horror film, Suspiria. It follows, you know, in somewhat the, you know, kind of the same idea for the story. A young woman, played by Dakota Johnson, kind of a farm girl, comes to Germany to participate in a this dance school, a very kind of famous dance school that is head up by Tilda Swinton. She gets there, you know, the things, you know, around the dance school is a bit odd, you could say. There are a lot of women there. It almost feels more like a convent in a way than a dance school. The number of women that are in charge of what's going on there. But, you know, unlike the Dario Argento film, we find out very early on in this film that the school is run by a coven of witches. There's another, you know, there are a couple other dancers in the group that are a little unnerved because they don't know what happened to another former dancer played by Chloe Grace Moretz, who we see in the opening scene, basically sort of on to what's going on in this school, and is relaying her thoughts to a therapist that, you know, let's not beat around the bush, is played also by Tilda Swinton. I'm not even going to entertain that whole fake actor persona dossier that they created for that. It's Tilda Swinton in old age man makeup. Okay. You know, the witches coven at the dance school are, you know, sort of preparing for a ritual that's going to bring back the mother of tears or the three mothers or something like that. And Dakota Johnson's dancer might just be the key to, you know, making this finally work. Her character begins to sort of ingratiate herself. She's, you know, a very, very skilled dancer. She knows all the moves. She listens very well and is sort of the perfect foil. And, you know, she begins to sort of like the attention that she receives. One of her few friends at the school, played by Mia Goth, is one of the girls who is, concerned about the Chloe Grace Moretz's character who's gone missing, and she begins to suspect that something else is going on at the school. That's probably a lot more plot.
Okay, hey,
than would ever be used to describe
Eric,
the Dario Argento.
Right, Eric, hang on a second.
Film. Okay.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski are here, and we are reviewing. We'll come back with our full reviews of the remake of Suspiria right after this on W. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on 720 WGN. Here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call and tell the joke. 312-981-7200 is our phone number for talk and text. And we're in the middle of the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric was telling us about Suspiria. Let's bring Eric back. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Jim.
Thank you.
All right. Eric, continue.
All right. So I've never been one to speak with the same kind of reverence for Argento's film that a lot of horror fans do. I've always sort of looked at Suspiria the same way that Graham Chapman looks at Camelot. Which is not to say that I don't admire what it accomplishes. You know, it's certainly a very weird, at times very spooky and unnerving film that is just kind of beautifully filmed and just kind of keeps you on edge, even though the plot makes no sense. It doesn't have much of a screenplay, and it's just kind of, you know, random. But, you know, a lot of really good horror films can be described in that manner. So there's something very interesting about a filmmaker tackling a project like this and taking a very simple idea, but then sort of expanding, themes or just inventing entirely new ones for it. The setting, for example, you know, the setting this, you know, where this film is set and sort of basking it in the, kind of the post-World War II guilt of Germany and the role of that women play in society, and also the constant stories on the news about the Lufthansa, not the heist, but the hijacking of a Lufthansa plane in 1977, right? That's when the movie takes place. It's constantly, you know, it's on you know, on everyone's minds and whatnot. So there's permutation that's going on throughout, you know, throughout the whole film. And I haven't even mentioned the fact that this movie is 2.5 hours long. So this guy's really leaning into some much larger ideas and themes, all of which I think are at many times very kind of half-baked. This is a film that is just, you know, brimming with ideas. You see them falling off the screen at times. I just never felt that any of them were particularly that well developed. It seemed that every time they tried to, you know, tackle one, another one would jump in and, you know, kind of, you know, fight for dominance at times. And you know, there are moments in this movie that do, you know, rise to the level of that creepiness that we, you know, hope to expect from a remake of Suspiria. There's a dance rehearsal scene about 40 minutes into the film that is pretty terrific. The climax is, you know, the kind of bloody thing that you hope this movie is eventually going to lead you down after, you know, two plus hours. But, well, I wouldn't call the movie dull by any respect. I just felt that the whole thing just kind of felt kind of pointless in a way, that, you know, taking us through these different tangents, and it just never felt very cohesive to me. And on top of it, Dakota Johnson can't carry a scene, let alone an entire movie. So as a rooting interest in what we're supposed to be going with, I was much more interested in Mia Goth's character, and even Chloe Grace Moretz, who I think is really terrific in the opening scene of this movie. But then every time they keep going back to Tilda Old Man Swinton, and, you know, the guilt that he feels for leaving his wife behind during the Holocaust, all of that just completely takes away from, you know, any sort of tension that's being built. Really, I didn't really feel much for that character. Every time I see it, I'm like, okay, it's Tilda Swinton in makeup. You know, I mean, Sleuth did a better job of masking characters than this movie does. And it's just so. I mean, I just kind of felt just kind of hollow watching the entire thing. While, you know, Dario Argento's film was basked in colors, this movie is kind of the opposite of that for a purpose. So even it's not as visually dynamic as that movie was. And so this is a long movie. It felt very long to me, and just ultimately was not that rewarding. Even, you know, by the time you get to the bloodshed by the end of the film, I was just like, okay, that's kind of what I expected to happen. And at the end, I was just like, oh, okay, it's over.
All right, Jim, what do you think?
This movie is bat crap crazy, and I think I loved it. It does have a lot going on, which I think it's going to take another viewing for me to completely grasp. Eric used the word unnerving in his review of the original, and I would say that's apt for both the original and this very loose remake. And I mean, like you, Nick, I'm a fan of the original as well as a few other Argento Giallo films, and it's nothing like his work. And I think that was a pleasant surprise, to be honest. There's a far more restrained score from the great Tom York. You know, it's the photography is more colorless. I thought the arc of Susie was interesting, and a lot of this just kind of flipped on its head, and I could tell the audience was pretty bewildered, and I kind of was too, but I was also really compelled by it. I mean, one of the earlier death scenes, I mean, I'm not going to give anything away, I wouldn't spoil it, but it's pretty jaw-dropping. It kind of shocked me to like few other films have, outside of maybe Hereditary this year. And a lot of these sequences do go on for a while. I mean, yes, it's 2 hours and 30 minutes. It's quite long, but I didn't care. I would say that I thought most of the things on display here worked. There, obviously, we touched upon the political subtext, but also I think there is something going on late in the film about believing women that is said, that I found very relevant to, you know, more recent times, and certainly just the portrayal of conflicted motherhood and sort of the haunting uncertainties of that, along with personal trauma. And I mean, again, it's like, yes, it is like kind of a messy mashup of ideas, and the execution of it is certainly messy, but I found it really kind of audacious and really disturbing. And it's one of those movies, I think, for those who are really adventurous and want something unique out of the horror genre, I think Suspiria is really something special. I can't wait to see it again, actually. I think it's kind of great.
Yeah. All right. Now, you guys know how outspoken I've been about this. The prospect of Suspiria being remade. Suspiria, the original Suspiria, is one of my favorite movies of all time. And the scariest movie I've ever seen. I was 12 years old when I saw it. Scared the crap out of me. And I still love it. Makes no sense. The movie makes not a lick of sense. And I don't care. It's just a fairy tale freak out. And I love every frame of it. I love the way it looks and everything. So I have a huge amount of love for the original Suspiria. Now, I went in with, you know, I tried to go in with an open mind. But I gotta say, I love this movie. I love it. And I like what Guadagnino did, the angle that he took. I love that he opened it up. I mean, it's an hour longer than the original movie. And I love what he did with it. I thought taking all of these themes about female empowerment and motherhood and setting them against this backdrop that really is interesting. His idea, he said, was that he wanted to make a movie that felt like he felt while watching Suspiria. And I get that. I totally get that. And he didn't really do a full-on remake. I mean, you know, the plot's the same, but the plot for Suspiria is girl goes to dance school, witches. That's it. That's basically the plot. And I think a lot of the stuff that he does here is really interesting. I think Tilda Swinton is fantastic as the doctor. I think she's great. And I know it's like stunt casting, obviously, to have her in old age male makeup. And I think she's fantastic as Madame Blanc as well. She has a third part that I won't. She has a third part that I won't give away either, and that's pretty awesome. That first moment with the intercutting between Dakota Johnson dancing and what's happening in the other dance room is a stunning, I mean, shocking, unbelievable sequence, and that really kicks the movie into high gear. I thought all of the stuff was interesting. I loved those flashes of nightmare flashes during the dream sequences that they have in the movie. I think it's a really creepy movie that really gets under your skin. The length didn't bother me at all. I mean, I was unnerved during most of it, and the last 20 minutes of this movie is insane. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. And I really want to mention, I thought the wonderful small role that Jessica Harper has in this movie is great, and I love
that was nice,
and I loved her in it. Yeah. It was great to see, because she's the star of the original, for people who might not know, and she's got a really important role in this movie, and I think a very emotional one. And I was with it, man. I was with it 100%. And I got to tell you, I know, Eric, you didn't like Dakota. I think Dakota Johnson's great in this movie. I think it's a great performance, and it gets deeper and more significant and creepier as it goes on. I think there's a real weird, wonderful arc that she plays in this movie. It's completely different than the character that Jessica Harper played in the original. But I was with it, and you know, I mean, there was jaw dropping stuff in this movie. I mean, the last 20 minutes, I was like, and I know it didn't make a lot of money over the weekend. It's not in a ton of theaters. But I can't imagine this thing not having walkouts. I can't imagine people, like, especially, like, you know, like after the first, like, really crazy scene, you know, that's a test right there. But if you're sitting through this movie and you get to the last 20 minutes, it's the absolute insanity. I mean, I was sitting in the screening room just going, I can't even believe this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, desensitized to a bit, but as bloody as it gets in those 20 minutes you referred to,
yeah,
I didn't feel it was that insane.
Oh, I did.
It felt like I had seen, you know, I had seen stuff like that in other movies before, and on top of it, I just didn't really care what was going on, so I was like, okay, well, that's okay, so they're just bloodying this thing up now. I don't feel this movie is as bat crap insane as people are giving it credit for.
Okay, well, I do. I think it's nuts, and I loved it, so, all right.
Yeah, and especially coming after the Halloween remake, which did very little.
Well, it's a better movie.
It's a much better, it's not even the same ballpark, man. So, all right, next week we've got the Grinch, we've got The Girl in the Spider's Web, which I'm really, really excited about, Overlord, which looks really weird.
Yeah.
Boy Erased.
I'm hearing good things about that one.
Boy Erased, and more. So that's all coming out next week. And Jim, thanks, man.
Happy to help anytime, man.
Okay,
thanks,
buddy.
A lot.
Yep, take care. And then, Eric, let's dive into the box office here.
Yeah.
All right. So, man, Bohemian Rhapsody made a lot of money. I did not see 50 million. I did not see 50 million coming.
I don't think I ever got to the point where I would have said 50 million coming. I mean, the reports were within the last like week or so that, you know, 40 million was very possible. I knew that this was when I made my sort of like preliminary holiday sort of box office guesses. I had Bohemian Rhapsody much lower. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what kind of interest people were going to have in this story. But then people around my age started, that it was like the top of their mind. Like, of all the movies that were coming out in the next couple months, this was the one, other than A Star Is Born, that they were asking me about.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen the Queen movie yet?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, not yet. I'm like, oh, you tell me when you see the Queen movie.
I'll tell you what, I
started like maybe this is going to be something.
Well, I saw it Saturday afternoon. My parents and I saw it Saturday afternoon, and we saw it in IMAX. It was packed. It was, I mean, I knew, and people applauded at the end. So, which aggravated me because I was so, I hated the movie so much. But like, no, I mean, this is a certified smash. I mean, I did not expect that.
Yeah. We didn't really touch upon all the backstory with the singer firing and all that kind of stuff. That's a whole other show, practically.
Right.
But there's something, you know, as much as we hated this movie, you know, movies about singers and bands and whatnot, you don't do this kind of business.
No, you're right.
They really don't.
Yeah.
I made a list of, like, all the movies that, you know, about singers that have done well, and we're talking, like, Pitch Perfect 2, Straight Out of Compton, and 8 Mile are, like, you know, amongst the top, you know, movies, and, you know, and then this beat out A Star Is Born as far as the opening is concerned. It's not going to touch Star Is Born's final number, but it's pretty huge, because I mean, Walk the Line only started with $22 million, and that's like fifth or sixth on this list. So it kind of gives me a weird sense of joy that the movie did well, only because it made me happy that people are still interested in Queen.
No, that's I agree with that 100%. It's a conflict to feel that way because I hated the movie so much. But then I was like, wow, $50 million for a Freddie Mercury movie. That's awesome.
Right. It's very cool. Yeah. And I don't think we're probably not, you know, even the kind of discounting, what kind of audience this had in the gay community.
Yeah.
How many, you know, showed up, you know, this weekend as, you know, reported to be, you know, as a gay icon that he is.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I mean, that obviously had to be a large chunk of this audience.
No question. Number two, Nutcracker in the Four Realms, $20 million. That's, I think that's pretty impressive for a movie that nobody even knew.
It's actually pretty bad.
Oh, is it really? Well, they spent a lot of money on it, right? Yeah.
As far as budget concerned, the budget is somewhere between 120 and 133 million.
Jeez.
A 20 million start in the U.S., the movie's, you know, going to be lucky if it hits 60, 65 million, I think, here. And if it doesn't make, I mean, it's already made like another 38 million overseas, which I think is going to make a larger chunk of its money, obviously.
Right.
But if it doesn't make $100 million overseas, you're talking about another $100 million loser.
Yeah.
And Disney's had quite a few of these lately that don't involve like Marvel, Star Wars, or Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this year, Wrinkle in Time. This year, Alice Through the Looking Glass, Tomorrowland, the number of movies they try to make these. I don't know if they're gonna franchise this thing, but it's a big special effects spectacular,
right?
And they spent a lot of money on it, and no one's really interested.
Yeah, the last one we'll talk about is the third one, Nobody's Fool, which is the latest Tyler Perry, Tiffany Haddish movie, $14 million. That's about right.
No. This is actually the third lowest opening in Tyler Perry's directorial career.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It's
exactly where I predicted it to be. I thought it was going to be kind of the low to mid-teens.
Yeah.
When I went over the list, it kind of surprised me that I thought there were a few more movies that did like around the $12, $13 million range, but no, there's only a couple.
Well, you know, do you think that this has something to do with, my theory is that people are on Tiffany Haddish overload. That's because she's in everything.
I don't even know about that. I think it might just be the opposite, that Tiffany Haddish is not that big a star as people think she is.
Oh, okay.
I kind of go that way. And also on top of it, I think people are kind of over the Tyler Perry thing.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
You know, I mean, that's a particular brand that, you know, shine bright for a while, but he's been, you know, when he doesn't put on the dress, the gross is not there.
Yeah. Well, so next week, what are we thinking? Is it going to be The Grinch? Will that be number one?
Yeah, The Grinch will be number one, okay. I think, very easily next week.
All right, cool. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
Okay.
All right, go listen to some Queen.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right, take care. Eric Childress, everybody, for box office and for movies, and we'll do it again next week. All right, let's take a break here on 720W. All right, everybody, we're going to hit the news here. Coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. That's coming up. But after the news, we're going to jump into more biopic conversations in honor of Bohemian Rhapsody, which is a movie that I absolutely hated. But we'll talk about good music biopics and some regular biopics based on true stories of real people. But we're going to kick it off with music biopics, and that's the conversation. If you want to jump in, if you have a favorite, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and we'll talk about the biopics. My dad will be calling in a little bit later on to tell a joke, because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. So get your music biopic topics ready to go and jump in here at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And, So, in honor of the release of Bohemian Rhapsody, which made a lot of money over the weekend, I wanted to talk more about music biopics. And then we'll get into biopics in general, but want to start with the music biopics from the past that we enjoy. As you heard, Eric and I, well, actually all three of us didn't like Bohemian Rhapsody, but Eric and I particularly hated it. So, Dan, I predicted that I was going to have some issues with the movie.
Yes.
But I didn't know I was going to hate it as much as I did.
Yeah.
Because they really, really, really took a lot of liberties with his story, man. I mean, there's inaccuracies in every scene. And some of them are unforgivable. As I mentioned before, the, changing, when he was actually diagnosed with HIV to make it before Live Aid is, it's unforgivable. So it's just a movie that made me angry, despite the fact that, Rami Malek is, he's doing the best he can. He's really terrific in it. And despite the fact that it's loaded with amazing music,
Wow. And you've mentioned in the past, like, listen, it's a movie. There's going to be creative license taken.
Yes.
Things are going to be moved around right. for dramatic effect. But there's a point where it just becomes fiction. And
yeah.
it sounds like
that's what happened.
Fictionalized
and
account as opposed to a biopic.
You're absolutely right. And I don't expect, 100% accuracy when you're making a movie. You have to do stuff for dramatic reasons, and I fully expected that going in. I just didn't expect it to be as absurd as it was. Something as simple as Brian May and Taylor were both on this project. They were it had to get past the rest of the members of Queen. It had to they had to okay it, so they okayed this stuff. Which, like I mentioned before, it's just ridiculous. At one point in the movie, they're like, "Hey, we're going to go on our first." They're all excited to go on our first tour, and so like their first U.S. tour, and they play Fat Bottom Girls, and Fat Bottom Girls is on the album Jazz, which is like years later in their career, and I'm like, well, this is just dumb. I mean, didn't Brian May go, that album was years later, so maybe you might not want to have them playing a song that they're not going to write for several years. What's supposed to be on their first tour. I mean, it's just that stupid. Like, how does that happen? Now, there have been a lot of good music biopics, and we have a bunch here that I want to talk about. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to jump in. 312-981-7200 with your favorite music biopics. Dan, does anything pop into your head right away?
It's a movie I actually haven't seen since childhood, but I remember loving it quite a bit, not only being, for the fact it's a fun movie and really good music, but just also I am the whitest Puerto Rican you will ever meet, but still I'm Puerto Rican and, understanding what that means to be Hispanic. So La Bamba was a movie that I remember had a big impact on me when I saw it as a kid, just kind of understanding the culture. Obviously he's Mexican and there's a little bit difference there, but overall just kind of, hearing that song and hearing how popular he was and kind of getting a window into that world was really interesting.
Yeah. The La Bamba is a terrific movie. I really enjoyed La Bamba, and it was interesting because when La Bamba came out, the song charted again. Like that's another thing that happens when these music bios come out. And I'm wondering if like Bohemian Rhapsody is gonna go nuts on Spotify now. You know what I mean? Like if the music of Queen is going to somehow hit the charts again in some way.
In the movie, did they re-record? Did Rami Malek re-record it, or did they use actual Queen songs?
It's a combination of the two. They used some of Freddie's vocals in there, but they had Rami sang some of them, and there's a guy who did vocals. I can't remember his name, but he did a lot of the vocals. Like say at the. During the end sequence when they basically recreate the Live Aid performance, that's a combination of all three of actual Freddie's actual voice, Rami, and the vocal coach. But La Bamba, I remember La Bamba that's the movie that basically were like, who is this Lou Diamond Phillips guy? Right. Because he pretty much came out of nowhere, and then had a career thanks to that movie. And I just remember when one of the iconic moments in that movie is when S.A. Morales goes, Richie, hey! And it's just like one of those moments that's like where you're just like, you're heartbroken. Obviously, it's a very sad, tragic thing. And covering that same thing is the Buddy Holly story, you know, because they both died in the same tragedy, in the plane crash, and the Big Bopper too. But you know, Buddy Holly's story was a really good movie, and Gary Busey, you know, my best friend Gary Busey, was nominated for an Academy Award for it. And if you look at Gary Busey now, and even back then, he didn't seem like the kind of guy. You know, Buddy Holly weighed about 95 pounds. You know, he was a skinny dude with the big glasses and the pompadour. And like, you don't think, when you think Buddy Holly, you don't immediately think Gary Busey, especially physically and especially now. Like, you can't, that guy can't play Gary Busey, but he's great in it. And it's a really terrific performance and a really good movie. And he did his own singing, too, in that movie. And it says, the 1978 film, The Buddy Holly Story, starring Gary Busey, the film depicts the life of the 50s musician who was best known for helping establish the classic rock and roll sound and for his hit, That'll Be the Day. Gary Busey sang all of the Buddy songs live during filming, earning him universal praise and an Academy Award nomination. And I remember, I vividly remember seeing that movie for the first time. I was 13, and my dad was, you know, my dad grew up during the rock and, you know, the big rock and roll era, you know, with all these guys creating rock and roll, and he loved Buddy Holly, and I'm trying to remember what theater we saw it at. I can usually remember what theaters. I think we saw it at the Ford City on the South Side, but yeah, I remember my dad really, really being moved by it. As a big, you know, original rock and roll Buddy Holly fan. And that's one of the good ones. That's definitely. And now, again, I don't know the story of Buddy Holly, you know, details and stuff like that as I do. Because the thing is, I Freddie Mercury is one of my heroes, I think the greatest frontman in the history of music. And so I've read a lot about Freddie Mercury. I followed their career. I very closely. I've been a Queen fan my whole life. And so, you know, knowing as much as I did going in to see Bohemian Rhapsody, and I'm, you know, and listen, if people want to go and see the movie, they're going to get and be entertained by it. That's fine. Just know that that's not the real story. That's not what happened, you know, and that's what aggravated me about the movie. Now, I know a lot of people went to see it. A lot of people really loved it. Dean loved it. Dean thought it was great. I just took it. I just kept getting angry because it was just not even close to the story that really happened to Freddie Mercury. And if you're going to make a movie about Freddie, especially if you've got the permission from the rest of Queen to do it, I mean, just, you know, Freddie Mercury was an amazing talent and so gifted and so special that he deserved more than that, you know, more than like a subpar TV movie that lies about what happened in his life. Because he was just such an extraordinary talent. He deserves so much better, you know? An iconic guy. So that's why I got so aggravated. I was really mad. Like, after my parents were like, let's just not even talk in the car on the way home because I think Nick's going to start busting stuff inside in the car. Because I was just really mad when we got out of the theater. You know? I will say this, though. I mean, the music and everything, seeing it in IMAX, you know, added to the music part of it. You know, that last 15 minutes when they recreate all of, you know, the Live Aid performance except for one song. It's pretty cool. It was pretty cool watching it in IMAX. So, I don't know. Best part of the movie was the trailer for Widows. That was the best part of the entire movie. I'm really looking forward to that movie. Dan, have you seen the commercials for this movie?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Eric reviewed it. I can't. I'm trying to remember what festival. I think it was Toronto.
Yeah,
I think
that
it was
sounds
Toronto.
Right.
And it's Viola Davis and the widows of these guys who stole money from Paperboy, Paperboy from Atlanta, and so they're going to do a heist. So these women are going to do a heist. Michelle Rodriguez, Viola Davis, and another I can't remember the other actress's name. They are going to pull off the last heist shot here in Chicago. It looks great. I mean, it looks really great. And Viola Davis rules. She's great in everything. But yeah, I mean, I've seen Colin Farrell's in it. Liam Neeson Robert Duvall? I mean, what the hell are we talking about here? So, anyway, we are talking about music biopics in honor of the release of Bohemian Rhapsody and the incredible box office success just this past weekend. I mean, it outperformed, it overperformed more than any of us, I thought it would. But yeah, so what do you guys think? Music biopics, 312-981-7200, and we'll jump into the phones and the texts and talk more about the best music biopics right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell the joke because it's a jokey time. And, yeah, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Call us up right now. Lines are open, and you can text us, too. 312-981-7200. And in honor of the opening of Bohemian Rhapsody, we're talking about music biopics. 312-981-7200. We got some texts here. Steve says, Eastwood did his homework. Whitaker nailed it. Bird is a must-see. I totally agree. That is a great movie, Bird, about Charlie Parker. And I mean, well, Clint Eastwood is a huge fan of jazz. You know, he's a musician as well, but he's just a, you know, he's very knowledgeable. He's a huge fan of jazz, and I thought Bird was great. I thought it was terrific. One of the best music biopics I think ever. That's way up near the top of the list of that one. 815 area code. The Glenn Miller Story, really good movie. Dan and Marengo says a must-see biopic is Searching for Sugarman about the singer Rodriguez. I had no idea how talented he was. It never became famous in the U.S. That's actually a documentary. We were actually talking about sort of the dramatic, you know, narrative stuff. But by the way, it's a great movie. Searching for Sugarman is a fantastic movie. That actually falls under the category of documentary. 630 area code says the movie Selena is one of my favorites. Yeah. That's the movie that basically broke Jennifer Lopez. That's the one.
That also holds a special place in our hearts because we got to watch it during Spanish class and got out of school, you know, class for 3 days.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Selena, which was released just 2 years after the shooting death of its subject, and Jennifer Lopez, who was then little known as an actress or a dancer, starred as the singer in what considered to be her breakout role. The 1997 film went on to cement Selena's status as a celebrated music icon that we lost too soon. Yeah, sad story. It was a good movie. I've only seen it the one time when it came out like 21 years ago. So I've only seen it the one time, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I thought Jennifer Lopez was good in that. Remember when Jennifer Lopez had us fooled?
How did she fool us?
That, well, we thought she was good.
Oh.
And she's not. So that's the...
I would say she's a different kind of good.
You mean with acting, not singing?
Well, I just think all of it encompassing. But I'm not a fan. Oh. Not a fan. I loved her. You know, the Clooney movie.
Out of Sight.
I loved her in that. Really loved her in that. And that was when I was like, oh, she's awesome. And then it went, no. She's good in Selena, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'm not a fan.
We also watched it in Spanish class. Dan,
did you? What's going on there?
That's a good, you know, that's a nice mid-range movie. It's probably 90 minutes, so that's 2-3 days.
Yeah.
Nothing overly offensive.
Well, that totally reminds me of, you know, of the religion classes right. That I had to take when I went to Luther North, when the teachers, like they would have, like, the football coaches teach the religion classes, and they'd be like, oh, man.
Because, oh,
wow. you know, like, every year, one of the coaches or one of those guys got stuck with it. It was like, okay, you got to teach the religion class this. And it would come down to this. They could, like a football coach or one of the other coaches would come in and go, all right, here's the deal. Just memorize the books of the Bible. I'll be in the back. And that's what we had to do. We had to memorize the books of the Bible. And then, like, all right, here's the idea. Here's what's going to happen. We're going to watch Godspell because that'll take about a week. And then the big one was Jesus of Nazareth because that was a mini.
Right.
That was a mini series. So that was like half the semester. You know, they didn't have to do anything. Just bring the AV unit in and go, all right, here you go. Here's your religious class. Enjoy Jesus of Nazareth. Just sit in the back, smoke cigarettes or something while we were watching Godspell for the 50th time. I happen to really enjoy Godspell. I really do. I think Day by Day is a jam. But, you know, I don't want to watch it. I mean, you know, we didn't care because we didn't do anything. Like you said, right. You're going to watch Selena. You're just going to sit in the classroom right. and not do anything. And the teachers were fine with that. The coaches were fine with that. They're like, here. I love that it was just like, all right, I'll be sitting over here. You guys just memorize the books of the Bible. How does that help us? What does that teach us? I mean, I don't. Well, I guess it teaches us what the books of the Bible are. You know, but it's just very strange. All right, how about this one? As far as music biopics go, this is one of the best. What's Love Got to Do with It? The Tina Turner biopic. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne and Angela Bassett are so good in that movie. I mean, it's just two phenomenal performances. And I mean, Angela Bassett just rules in it. And yeah, I remember when that movie came out, man. It was a sensation. It's the 1993 Tina Turner biopic, What's Love Got to Do with It, which is based on Tina's best-selling autobiography, earned critical acclaim for its phenomenal acting and no-holds-barred depiction of domestic violence. Angela Bassett, who played the Proud Mary singer, and Lawrence Fishburne, who starred as Ike Turner, both earned Academy Award nominations for their portrayal. Who won that year? So it would be the films of 1993. So it would be the 1994, whenever the ceremony was in 1994. I know that was Schindler's List. I know that was the big winner that year. I know Liam Neeson was nominated, but he didn't win. I'm trying to remember who won Best Actor in 90. Oh, it was Tom Hanks for Philadelphia. Hanks for Philadelphia, and I'm trying to remember the actress who won Best Actress. But yeah, Hanks won for Philadelphia, but I don't remember what woman won for Best Actress.
I'm trying to pull it up.
Yeah. But I will tell you something. Angela Bassett was amazing in that movie. And she was absolutely amazing and, you know, should have won, I think. But I just don't remember who the female winner was that year. So,
the winner was Holly Hunter in The Piano.
Oh, well, okay. Well, then that was correct. I'm sorry. As great as Angela Bassett was, Holly Hunter is incredible in The Piano and deserved that Oscar. Boy, what a tough competition right there. You get two performances like that. You know, you get Holly Hunter and you get Angela Bassett the same year. That's pretty amazing. But I actually agree with the Academy because The Piano is one of my favorite movies ever. So, and I love Holly Hunter. All right. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we got the news. And then after the news, we'll jump right back into the movie biopic. We're talking about What's Love Got to Do with It and a bunch of other ones that we've been talking about. We'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. All right, news is coming up after this. Welcome back. How's everybody doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We would love you to join us. We are talking about music biopics because Bohemian Rhapsody came out, did extraordinarily well at the box office over the weekend. Despite the fact that I hated it. But we're talking about good music biopics. And let's see. Peter in Decatur says, as I recall, Steve and Johnny absolutely hated the Johnny Cash biopic Walk the Line, more so with Steve. They did. They hated it. I don't remember. They probably hated it for the same reason that I hated Bohemian Rhapsody. You know what I mean? Because it was inaccurate. That's probably why it was. But I don't know as much about Johnny Cash as I do about Freddie Mercury. So that's why I was a little harsher on that one. This is a 2005 biopic depicted not only the life of Johnny Cash, but also his relationship with his wife, June Carter. Walk the Line, starring Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny and Reese Witherspoon as June, featured chemistry between its two leads and a detailed look at Johnny's iconic career. The film went on to earn 5 Academy Award nominations, and Reese won Best Actress for her performance. It grossed more than $186 million worldwide. So it was a big hit. I liked it. I just, you know, I don't know. I'm assuming that Steve and Johnny probably know a lot more about Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash than I do. That would be my guess. But I thought the performances were both really good. I thought Reese Witherspoon was terrific. 773 area code says Ray with Jamie Foxx was a good biopic, and not a fan. Not a fan. That was it. That was the year I was very angry that year, Dan. Because you know, Jamie Foxx was winning everything, okay? And I don't think he's I don't think he's great in the movie. I don't. And that was the year of Sideways when Paul Giamatti got snubbed, didn't even get nominated for Sideways, and it was the best performance of the year of that year. And I was just remember I took it out on Jamie Foxx because I was just so angry. I was so mad that Paul Giamatti didn't, you know, get the recognition that he deserved for his performance in Sideways. Steve says, what about Sid and Nancy? Sid and Nancy's a great movie. Now, accurate? No. Great? Yes. I love that movie. Sid and Nancy's a great movie. Not a lot of it, you know, really took place the way that it's portrayed in the movie, but the movie does have sort of a kind of a... Have you seen Sid and Nancy, Dan?
I have not.
It does have sort of a fantastical style to it, especially at the end. It gets real weird at the end. Very fantasy-oriented. But that tone is set up at the beginning of the movie as well. Gary Oldman is so good in it, man. That's, again, that breakout performance right there. You want to talk about it? Nobody knew who Gary Oldman was before Sid and Nancy. And after Sid and Nancy, he's like, oh, who's this guy? And it took him until last year to win an Oscar. You know? By the way, the dude who wrote the Churchill movie wrote Bohemian Rhapsody.
Really?
He wrote that. He wrote like biopics is his deal.
Are they all British biopics too?
Yes. In fact, they are. Yes, because his other one is The Theory of Everything.
There you go.
So it's Theory of Everything. He wrote The Theory of Everything. He wrote Darkest Hour, and he wrote Bohemian Rhapsody. That's his thing. So, and they're not particularly great screenplays either. let's see. Here is Julie on WGN. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Nick. Hi. How are you doing?
All right.
Good. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Hey, and I'm bummed out about Bohemian Rhapsody because I wanted to go see it because I love Queen, but I don't know. I don't think I will.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, everybody's going to have a different reaction to it. Like I said right. earlier, you know, Dean loved it. Dean Richards loved it. And I just had such a close connection to the story that I couldn't allow the inaccuracies. I couldn't get past them. Because there were just so many of them, and they were so blatant, and I just...
That's a shame.
I got angry, so...
Didn't do him justice, but...
No.
The reason I called, dear, was The Temptations. I thought was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
I don't know if there was more than one, but this one had Leon,
yep.
one of the actors.
Yep. They did a TV movie about The Temptations. That was a made-for-TV movie about The Temptations. And then there's we were talking about this one before. We were talking about The Five Heartbeats. The Five Heartbeats was the Robert Townsend movie that was based on not just The Temptations, but all of those guys. You know, like those groups, all of those groups from the 60s and 70s. But there was one, I think it was a TV movie. I know it was a TV movie, but I think there was maybe one or two movies made about The Temptations. And they were good. All right, Julie, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. You know, when we were talking about box office for the bios, the music biopics from the past, Eric was talking about how Straight Outta Compton was like one of the biggest successes in that category, and it was a massive success. Straight out, and it's a good movie too. Straight Outta Compton. This biopic was a surprisingly huge success back in 2015, making more than $200 million against its $50 million budget, and scoring an Academy Award nod for Best Original Screenplay. Straight Outta Compton depicts the rise and fall of iconic hip hop group N.W.A. It starred newcomers Corey Hawkins and Jason Mitchell, as well as Ice Cube's lookalike son O'Shea Jackson Jr. The movie has laughs, tears, electric rap performances, and more. So, hey, and speaking of Paul Giamatti, Paul Giamatti, Straight Out of Context? Context. That's the bit we do here on the show. Sorry. Straight Out of Compton. I really enjoyed that movie. And my favorite scene in the entire movie, and I've talked about this before, is after Ice Cube leaves NWA. They go after him, Eazy-E and the rest of the guys in NWA. they go after him in a couple of songs. And so he didn't go after them on Ice Cube's first solo record. He did not go after the guys from NWA. But then when they drew First Blood, he recorded a song on his second album called No Vaseline, which is perhaps the most brutal attack on rappers ever. I mean, it is unbelievable. And it's a great song, but the best part of Straight Outta of Compton is the recording of No Vaseline. Like, they have a scene where Ice Cube is recording No Vaseline. He's like, "Oh, they want to play? All right, you guys want to play? You want me to come after you? I'll come after you." And it's just this brutal song. If you can't play. I mean, the title alone should probably kind of indicate what direction the song goes. The song is called No Vaseline, and it is one of the most brutal hip hop songs ever. And he rips apart the rest of NWA. And in the movie, they show him recording it, and it's intercut with NWA and their manager, played by Paul Giamatti, listening to it in his office. And it is the best. It's the best scene in the entire movie. And it's what's really funny is because, Paul Giamatti plays, and he goes after Giamatti. Giamatti's character talks about, because, Giamatti is Jewish, and he goes after, and Ice Cube goes after him for being, for letting NWA's money be handled by this guy. And it's, it's not kind. It's really, it's all, and so the first time in the movie, Paul Giamatti's character has been defending this kind of rap, throughout the first part of NWA's career, because they wrote really, really fiery and nasty rap. And here's this, this white Jewish guy who's defending it, and so when they're listening to the song and he gets, they Ice Cube goes after him too, the management. And they're all in there, and the guy playing Eazy-E is like, "Oh my God," he's like rubbing his, they can't believe how far Cube went to insult them and just really nail him. And as soon as the song is over, Giamatti's like, "That's the most offensive thing I've ever heard, and we need to stop it right now. This can't be allowed." For the rest of the movie, he was fine until Ice Cube ripped him a new one. It's a good movie, though. Now, Straight Outta Compton is a really good movie, and it was a massive success. I mean, that was it didn't come out of nowhere, but I thought it would be successful. I didn't think it would be the big crossover hit that it was, because there's a lot of hip hop fans out there and a lot of fans of NWA and Cube and all those guys. But it crossed over much more. I thought it was going to have more of a niche crowd, of people who really loved hip hop and stuff like that. But anyway, a really good movie. So, well, we're talking about music biopics. 312-981-7200. Which ones are your favorites? So we're going to break here for weather, and then we'll come back for more here about the best music biopics. So I got the weather right here. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And more. And coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6 o'clock is Steve Cochran for your morning drive. And then coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN Radio. Okay, we've been talking about music biopics. If you'd like to join us, our phone lines are open and the text lines are open too at 312-981-7200. How about The Sound of Music? A classic. The Sound of Music starred legend Julie Andrews as Maria Von Trapp and Christopher Plummer as Captain Von Trapp. It tells the story of the real Trapp family singers. The 1965 movie earned 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, and by 1966, it had become the highest-grossing film of all time, a distinction it held for 5 years. Now considered a true classic, The Sound of Music was selected for preservation by the National Film Registry in 2001. Wow, it took that long? Wow. So, Now, I did not see this one. Notorious. This is about the Notorious B.I.G. I never saw this movie. How did I not see this?
Didn't it come out about the same time as Straight Outta Compton?
No, this was Straight Outta Compton was 2015. Notorious was 2009.
Oh, so it was a long time in between.
Yeah. Is there a movie about Tupac? Yeah.
All Eyes on Me.
All Eyes on Me. That came out around the same time. Didn't that come out a couple of years ago?
Within the last 2 years. It was after Straight Outta Compton because it was one of those things a lot of people were interested to see if it could have the same success.
Right.
My bad. Just got East Coast and West Coast confused.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. Yeah, don't do that. The All Eyes on Me, that guy looks exactly like Tupac. The actor who they had played Tupac, he looks exactly like him. But anyway, Notorious was from 2009. It a biopic that told the story of the music legend whose life was taken too soon. Produced by P. Diddy. Notorious depicts the life of Brooklyn rapper, the Notorious B.I.G. His real name is Christopher Wallace. The movie stars young acting phenom Angela Bassett as Valletta Wallace and newcomer Jamal Warlord as Biggie in a widely praised performance. The movie's a mother's story, Diddy told MTV News right before the film's released. His mother is the driving force of the movie Getting Done, and I wanted the movie to speak for itself, so I haven't been out there overhyping it. Truth be told, I was blown away by the movie. I've never saw that one. The Runaways. This was kind of a disappointing movie. But I thought Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning were both great in it. Kristen Stewart, Dakota Fanning star in this music biopic that chronicles the early days of the all-female rock band The Runaways. The 2010 film features a dynamic performance from Kristen as Joan Jett and encompasses the female empowerment of the 70s. It's based on the lead vocalist Sherry Curry's book, Neon Angel, a memoir of a runaway. You want to know what the best part of that movie is, Dan? Have you seen The Runaways?
I have.
Michael Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Shannon, who plays it. Michael Shannon is unbelievable in that movie. Like, he steals every scene he's in. But I thought Kristen Stewart and I thought Dakota Fanning were both good in it. That was one of those by the numbers. You know what I mean? That was definitely sort of the by the numbers. And I don't think it went into as much behind the scenes stuff as it should have. But Michael Shannon, Michael Shannon is always good, but he's particularly weird. And I mean, like, weird and fun in that movie. Like, he really goes for it in that movie. And that was right around the time when I started to realize that, like, Kristen Stewart was the real deal. You know, she wasn't just the terrible actress from Twilight and now the Twilight movies. And now we realize that, in fact, she's awesome and is now doing, like, really cool, risky work in independent movies. And she's great. I think Kristen Stewart is great. I just think she's great. I never would have thought that because she did that. She did those stupid Twilight movies. And then she did the Snow White thing, which was also terrible. But then she started, you know, like, doing the kind of stuff she's doing now. And I think she's great. I think she's actually one of my favorite actresses right now. Jersey Boys, the 2014 musical biopic, which tells the stories of the singing group The Four Seasons, grossed more than $67 million worldwide, directed and produced by Clint Eastwood. Jersey Boys stars acting legend Christopher Walken and Broadway star John Lloyd Young. In a surprising twist, the film's actors recorded all the music live. While keeping the stage show feel, having live vocals and music also raises the emotional performances in the scenes, said re-recording mixer John Reitz. Jersey Boys is a story about four guys, and the songs are part of the journey. The live performances only added to the realism. I wasn't crazy about that movie. Dan, did you ever see the show?
I did see the show.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's very entertaining.
Very entertaining show. Very entertaining show. I just don't think they did a really great job with the movie. And, you know, Clint's got another movie coming out. I mean, he's 86 years old? The guy makes at least one movie a year, sometimes more. And he's in this one. He not only directed it, produced it, he's in it.
88.
88! He's 88! Man, oh man, I'm 53. I can't walk up the stairs. This guy's making five movies a week, and he's 88. Yeah, this new one coming out in December looks real good, man. It's called The Mule, and he plays a guy who's running drugs. It plays like a 90-year-old guy who's running drugs. The trailer looks pretty fantastic, and Bradley Cooper's in it. Who else? Forrest Whitaker, I believe, is in it. Michael Pena. Sorry, Michael Pena's in it. So that's The Mule. That comes out in December. But Jersey Boys, I was disappointed in. Because it's different than they he did it. He really didn't do it like the stage play at all. He made it. Because the play is just basically music. It's just all music. I mean, it tells a story, but it's definitely a musical. And Clint really didn't make it wasn't a proper sort of musical. And he changed some stuff. So I wasn't I was not crazy about Jersey Boys. Let's see. Harold says, "How about your cheating heart?" George Hamilton played Hank Williams. For me, it was a tearjerker. Also, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Cuba Gooding and Angela Bassett plays one of Frankie Lyman's wives. George Hamilton is Hank Williams. That had to be a TV movie, right? That couldn't have been a theatrical release. George Hamilton is Hank Williams? 815 area code says, a good older one is Coal Miner's Daughter. Coal Miner's Daughter is a great movie, and Sissy Spacek is great in it. Does her own singing in that movie.
It looks like it was a release, by the way.
Is that right? It was a theatrical release?
1964.
Wow. Okay. See, you know, 1964, George Hamilton was a different guy. He wasn't as crispy as he is now. You know, George Hamilton also played Evel Knievel in a biopic about Evel Knievel.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. We got the news coming up and then more about music biopics and biopics in general. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little bit. It's a jokey time. And we've been talking about music biopics. Bohemian Rhapsody, while not a movie that I enjoyed at all, did make a ton of money over the weekend. And so in honor of that, we're talking about music biopics. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Here is Ike in Country Club Hills. Hi, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with
Good.
You, man? Okay, I have two comments I want to make about biopics. The first one is one of the ones I remember, and this is the classic one. And I'm fortunately going to get a kick out of this because this is just also my favorite filmmaker as well, just like yours, John Carpenter, Elvis with Kurt Russell.
Yeah, great movie.
Oh, yeah. Of course, that was the first time him and Kurt Russell and Carpenter teamed up together and went on to a lot of good movies like The Thing and Big Trouble in China, Escape from New York.
Right. Yeah, no, and Elvis was, that movie was, I remember when it first aired, it was on up against the television premiere of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on NBC, and CBS was showing Gone with the Wind at the same time, and Elvis beat both of those in the ratings. It was nobody expected that, but it was like everybody watched it when it came out, because it was only a year after Elvis died, because the Elvis had died in 77 and this came out about a year after. It was in 1978. It was actually the same year as Halloween.
And Kurt Russell nailed it.
He's great.
He did the third. Remember 3,000 Miles to Graceland?
Yeah.
He kind of get a comeback as Elvis for this year.
Well, he was in an Elvis movie. He was in as a kid.
Yeah, when he was a kid.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, of course. Recently, I just listened to the audio book of Billy Idol's book, Dancing with Myself. And of course, I'm a huge Billy Idol fan. And
right.
I'm like, this needs to be made a movie because that guy is so cool.
Yeah.
Have you read his book?
No, I have not. I have not.
You gotta read it, man. He is so knowledgeable. He is so cool, man. You gotta check. I hope they make it to him.
All right. Thank you, Ike.
No problem.
Take care. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Donna in Chicago says the Doors movie was so bad. Oh, it was so bad. It was good. No, I don't know if I, I don't know if I'd go that far. I thought that movie was ridiculous. Let's see. As far as I saw Bohemian Rhapsody, Rami was great, but I think it was watered down. It was more than that, Donna. 708 area code, the movie Amadeus with Tom Hulce and F. Murray Abraham. Great movie, great music, great movie. I totally agree. Amadeus is phenomenal. Such a great movie. So they mentioned The Doors here in this article. Dan, have you seen The Doors with Val Kilmer?
I have not.
Oh, man. I mean, it's Oliver Stone, so it's ridiculous. I mean, that just kind of goes hand in hand. Val Kilmer gave one of his most memorable performances ever as rock icon Jim Morrison in the 1991 film The Doors. I will say this. Kilmer's good in it. He's like Rami Malek, he came to play. Like, Rami Malek did the best he possibly could and threw himself into the role of Freddie Mercury. There's no question about that. Unfortunately, there was nothing in the script, and the same holds true with Val Kilmer. But Val Kilmer was, you know, because Dan, you know Val Kilmer's a head case.
Yes.
And was at his most method when he played Jim Morrison. Like, nobody on the set could call him Val. It was either that he would only answer to Jim or the Lizard King. If somebody said Val, he wouldn't answer. He stayed in character the whole time. But that movie is ridiculous. It is completely ridiculous. It says, perfectly showcasing the wild, free-loving, drug-using world of the 1960s rock superstar, this biopic shows all the ups and downs in Jim's short life. Meg Ryan also shines as Jim's girlfriend, Pamela Corson. The movie faced criticisms, and some of Jim's family and friends did not like the depiction of the music legend. We had mentioned Amadeus got mentioned. The majority of celebrated music biopics about present day artists are about present day audience, but this excellent biopic tells the story of 18th century composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Amadeus, released in 1984, chronicles Mozart's life through the words of his rival Antonio Salieri. The movie was nominated for 53 awards at 140, including 8 Academy Awards, 1 for Best Picture, 4 BAFTAs, 4 Golden Globes, and a Directors Guild Prize of America. And it's a good movie. A really, really good movie. And it's long. It's three hours. You're gonna be... Dan, have you seen Amadeus?
I have not.
Oh, it's so good, man. So, so good. Tim says, I think many liberties were taken on The Greatest Showman. Therefore, I don't know how much of a biopic it is about P.T. Barnum, but I adore every frame of that film. I saw it in the theater 4 times, which I've never done before, and I thought it was great. Yeah, The Greatest Showman, that was one of those movies that kind of snuck out last year. And every week we were doing the box office, it was always in there, and it ended up making a ton of money. Made a ton of money, Hugh Jackman. I enjoyed it. I don't know. Again, I'm not an expert on P.T. Barnum, but I don't think it's quite accurate. 847 area code says, I enjoy Beyond the Sea. Yeah, you know, except that, you know, I mean, Kevin Spacey wrote and directed it, and he plays Bobby Darin in it. And he was way too old to play Bobby Darin. He was way too old to play Bobby Darin for when the movie takes place. It wasn't a terrible movie. I just thought, well, this was a passion project for Spacey. And, you know, when he made it, he was like, I don't care if I'm too old. This is the story I want to tell, so I'm going to play Bobby Darin. 773 area code says the Jacksons. That was another TV movie. I don't know how accurate that one is either. How about Crazy, Sexy, Cool, the TLC story? That was VH1, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right.
The TV movie Crazy, Sexy, Cool, the TLC story depicts the lives of TLC, one of the most popular and successful girl groups in history. Airing on VH1, the 2013 film cast Kiki Palmer as Chili, Drew Sidora as T-Bose, and Lil Mama as Lisa Left Eye Lopez. Crazy, Sexy, Cool rides an emotional roller coaster as the women rise to fame and is remembered for its solid acting performances. Yeah, that's quite a story, the TLC. Now, I didn't see this movie. I remember it being advertised. I never did see it. I saw parts of it, but not the whole thing. I'm assuming they covered Left Eye burning down the house. I mean, they have to. Who was the football player?
Andre Rison.
She burns down his house. you don't want to mess with Left Eye, man. So, all right. So that's Crazy Sexy Cool, the TLC story, VH1. That's also included here as a good music biopic. 312-981-7200. That's the phone number. We would love to hear from you on this topic for text or talk. 312-981-7200. Hi, everybody. How's it going? How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m., and it's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are talking about music biopics, and we'll get into regular biopics, too. If you want to jump in, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. How about this one, Great Balls of Fire? This 1989 film stars a young Dennis Quaid as Jerry Lee Lewis in the heyday of his career and his eventual downfall after marrying his 13-year-old cousin, Myra Gale Brown. Great Balls of Fire is celebrated for depicting the classic 50s rock and roll scene and for Dennis's eccentric yet fun-loving performance. The movie also stars Winona Ryder as Myra and Alec Baldwin as Jimmy Swaggart, the Christian evangelist. I remember Steve and Johnny were mixed on that one. Because I think they got a lot of the details, a little bit wrong on that. But Dennis Quaid is really good in it. Yeah, and Alec Baldwin's great as Jimmy Swaggart. He's fantastic. How about Alec Baldwin allegedly punching people?
Yeah, I didn't read the story. Over a parking spot.
Over a parking spot.
Was it New York?
Yeah. Alec Baldwin. He's got a talk show now.
I do.
On ABC on Sunday nights. And it's not bad. It's just a one-on-one. There's no audience. The episode I saw had Ricky Gervais and Jeff Bridges. So, it's like two of my favorite people in the world. And I thought both interviews were really good. Jeff Bridges is just the man. Just the man. I get a little upset, though, when people are interviewing Jeff Bridges and they're doing like a... like a summation of, because obviously, the movie that everybody goes to now is A Big Lebowski. That's the one that, and so weird, because when that movie came out, it did not do well. I mean, it did not do well at all. And so, now 20 years later, this year is the 20th anniversary of The Big Lebowski. For that to be the movie that he's most known for is really crazy. I mean, he's great in it, and he is the dude. There's no question about it, but. It's weird if you followed the history of that movie, because that was the Coen brothers' follow-up to Fargo, and they had won, the Academy Award for that, and it won, and it was just a big, big deal. And so they follow up Fargo with this weird pot bowling movie. And I thought it was hilarious. I remember the first time I saw it, I thought it was really funny. But I went with a group of people who were not as high on it as I, no pun intended, who didn't like it nearly as much as I did. And then it took repeated viewings for people to get to it. But that's like the one that they go to. But every time I watch an interview with Jeff Daniels, and they're going back and talking about some of his great performances, and he's got so many. I mean, he's my favorite actor. But nobody ever talks about Fearless, which is, I still think, the best performance he's ever given is in Fearless. And it very rarely gets mentioned, And I think it should, because it's such a great movie, and just a powerhouse movie, and it's my favorite performance of Jeff Bridges. But anyway, the Alec Baldwin show is pretty good. I like it. All right. So Alec Baldwin is Jimmy Swaggart in Great Balls of Fire. How about Get On Up, which is the James Brown biopic that helped to solidify Chadwick Boseman's status as an acting powerhouse. Get On Up was released in 2014 and also stars Viola Davis as James' mother, Susie Brown, and the late Nelson Ellis as singer. Bobby Byrd, as singer Bobby Byrd. Chadwick didn't initially want to play the Godfather of Soul because James is too legendary, but he eventually changed his tune. I knew that everybody was involved, everybody was going to be involved, was going to be at the top of their game, so why not try, he told the Hollywood Reporter. Then he played, who else did he play? He played Jackie Robinson, and he played three.
Thurgood Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall, that's right. And then, of course, he's Black Panther. So, let's see. It's a pretty good career going on with this guy. Coal Miner's Daughter, which we mentioned a little bit earlier, this 1980 biopic stars Sissy Spacek as country singer Loretta Lynn and earned her an Academy Award for Best Actress. Coal Miner's Daughter was adapted from Loretta's 1976 autobiography and also stars Tommy Lee Jones as Loretta's husband, Mooney Lynn. The film showcases all the ups and downs of Loretta's life, from being a harried mother of four at age 19 to the release of her first hit, I'm a Honky Tonk Girl. I remember Levon Helm played her father in that movie. And he had never acted before. I mean, everybody knows him from The Band. But he'd never really acted before. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he got nominated for supporting actor for it. But he was terrific in the movie. We mentioned Byrd. Byrd, produced and directed by Clint Eastwood, chronicles the life of jazz saxophonist Charlie Byrd Parker. The 1988 film stars a young Forest Whitaker as Charlie and focuses on his relationship with common law wife Chan Parker, his childhood, career, and early death at age 34. Dreamlike scenes and sequences dominate the film, making it one of the most creative music biopics of all time. Yeah, I would agree with that. So, let's see. 219 area code sends in a text, and you can too at 312-981-7200. Lady Sings the Blues. Ah, yes. Lady Sings the Blues with Diana Ross, Billy Dee Williams, and, of course, Richard Pryor is in that movie. 630 area code says, the best is Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. Well, yeah. we were actually unfavorably comparing Bohemian Rhapsody to that ridiculous Walk Hard movie, because all of those stupid cliches that are made fun of in that movie are in Bohemian Rhapsody, but not satirically. That you were meant to take these stupid things seriously while you're watching Bohemian Rhapsody. All right. 8 Mile, which we mentioned a little bit earlier. 8 Mile was released 2002. It was heavily based on Eminem's life growing up in Detroit and stars the rapper in the lead role. The hip-hop icon plays Jimmy B. Rabbit Smith Jr. as he juggles a dysfunctional family, pursues his rap ambitions, and escapes his trailer park upbringing. The gritty film was an unexpected hit, earning critical acclaim and winning an Academy Award for Best Original Song for Lose Yourself. Yeah, that was a big hit, that movie. That was a real big hit, like a crossover sort of sensation. And it was mentioned a little bit earlier this morning on the show, not just because it's a music biopic, but because there's a movie about rap battling that came out this weekend called Bodied, which Eric reviewed for us and absolutely loved. And he's not a real big hip hop rap or, you know, rap battle guy. He'll be the first to tell you, but he thought this movie was terrific. And it's called Bodied, playing at the River East Theater downtown. So, all right, so there are some of the best music biopics. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200, and then we're just going to go into general biopics. What are some of the best, just general biopics that don't necessarily have to be music-related? 312-981-7200. And we'll talk about some of those coming up as well. Like we mentioned a little bit earlier, Schindler's List, which won Best Picture in 1993, that's listed as one of the best biopics of all time. Obviously, based on a true story, and considered one of the best of all time. Raging Bull, considered one of the best biopics of all time. I would agree with that. And obviously De Niro is, you know, obviously phenomenal in it. And, you know, don't overcook the steak. It defeats its own purpose, which is still one of my favorite lines. don't, Don't overcook the steak. It defeats its own purpose. I don't even know. I have to say, you know, that's a really hard movie to watch sometimes, you know, because the central character is just so abusive and so nasty. But it's also really funny. There's a lot of funny stuff in Raging Bull. Like, really, a lot of the stuff between him and Pesci, phenomenal. Yeah. And it also, Joe Pesci, he won Best Supporting Actor. Did he win Best Supporting Actor for that? No, he didn't. He won for Goodfellas. And it's the shortest speech in you know this, right, Dan?
I do, yeah.
Shortest speech in Oscar history. He just said, I think it's something like, I thank you for this. And then he leaves. And everybody was like, all right. All right. Let's take a break here on WGN. And we got the news coming up after this. Welcome back. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. And as Mary came in this morning, Mary Vandeveld came in this morning, she told me that, like, her son-in-law is really mad at me. Is it... let me get Mary in here.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
So it's your son-in-law who's mad at me?
My son-in-law is a musician, yeah. And he was so mad because, yes, he saw it on Saturday night.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, he saw Bohemian Rhapsody with my daughter. Yeah. And so yesterday we're watching the football game, and I read your text, you know.
Or my post.
Facebook post. Yeah. And I go, oh, you got to read this from Nick DiGiulio, you know. He's like, oh, boy. And he probably goes, what? And he's just sitting there yelling. And I said, well, you got to understand, Nick's a movie critic. He's very into Queen. He knows the story. Yeah. And, you know, he took it literally.
Well, here's the thing. I know a lot of people, you know, a ton of people went to, I mean, it made $50 million on the weekend.
Yeah.
It made a lot of money. And I know a lot of people enjoyed it. The crowd that I saw it with, you know, there was applause at the end of the movie. It's just that I'm too familiar with the story. The amount of inaccuracies and blatant lies that are in the movie is kind of staggering. So it just got me mad. But the music's great. I saw it in IMAX. It was nice and loud.
And the actor's great.
Yeah, Malick. I mean, he's really terrific.
Malick,
Rami Malek. He's really terrific. It's unfortunately he's not given much to do. You know, in the script.
He doesn't sing.
Well, he does sing. Yeah, I mean, he sings. You know, they have a combination of they used him and they used another vocal coach. To provide, because you need three people to try and replace Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know the story too well, and Freddie Mercury, in my opinion, is the greatest singer in rock and roll history and one of the greatest front men ever. And I just kept getting mad and madder and madder and madder as the lies and.
But you didn't leave.
No, I didn't leave. The last 15 minutes is the best part of the movie. The last 15 minutes is them recreating the entire Live Aid performance.
Oh.
That's the last 15 minutes in the movie, and he's amazing in the last 15 minutes. But the other thing about it is that, you know, sitting through this movie was really aggravating for me because it's so inaccurate and so wrong. And then you don't even have to sit through it because the actual Live Aid performance is available on YouTube. And it's one of the greatest live performances in the history of music was the 20 minutes that they played at Live Aid. I vividly remember watching my friends and I watching it live as it happened. And when it was over, we were like, no, I don't know who's going to try and follow that.
Oh,
you know, I can't remember who followed it. Nobody remembers who followed it. Everybody just remembers. And I remember watching it and just being stunned by it.
But, I wonder how many people are going to watch it now after seeing the movie.
Yeah. No, I'm sure it's spiking on YouTube right now. But that was my thing about the movie was if you all care about Freddie Mercury's life, don't see the movie and just watch the actual video of the real footage. So
Yes. And I know you've been talking about it all morning, but I'm really excited to see this movie because, A, I love Rami Malek. I'm a Mr. Robot fan. B, I know absolutely nothing about Queen, so it's going to be a new story.
No, well, you still won't know anything about Queen if you see this movie.
Wonderful.
So you won't know anything. You won't know anything that really happened to Queen after you see the movie. But the music's great. That's all I'm saying. If you like Rami Malek, he came to play. Like, he totally immersed himself in this role. I got to give it to him, you know?
So are there any books you would recommend? There's got to be a million Queen books.
There are a bunch, man. I'm trying to remember. I've read, like, 3 books about Freddie Mercury and Queen, and I can't remember the titles right now.
Yeah, well, maybe you should try to, tell people.
What's the actual... And also,
Because I'd like to tell my son or buy him the book or something, you know?
Yeah, because I should probably look those up, the ones that I've read, but I haven't read it in years. And also... I followed his career as it was happening, not just, reading books and stuff, but I followed his career. Like, at one point in the movie...
Right, they were alive.
They say, yes, no, absolutely, yeah. They were, a seminal band for me when I was growing
up. Right, me too.
But at one point in the movie, simple stuff like this infuriated me. At one point in the movie, they say that they got their very first tour of the United States, and they're all excited about it. And then the next thing you know, they're on tour and they're playing Fat Bottom Girls, which is on their 7th album, not their first album.
Oops.
So it's like, how can you make a mistake like that,
Well, maybe they just had to fit Fat Bottom Girls in somewhere and that was the only place they could.
Well, not maybe on the first tour. Come on.
It's okay. Nobody would have known.
Everybody would know.
Well, you.
I know.
I wouldn't have.
Anyway, so my apologies to your son-in-law. I'm just tell him I'm sorry.
He didn't care. He's like, yeah, whatever. Everybody's got their own opinion.
It's exactly. Like, it's not going to stop. I mean, it's like my opinion is not going to stop people from seeing this movie.
No way.
Which, of course, is the case of any of the movies that I review. But this one especially because it's got a powerhouse behind it, and it's made $50 million over the weekend.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it won't be number one next week at the box office because The Grinch comes out next week. But it'll still be way up there, and I'm sure I wouldn't be surprised if it makes like 30, 35 million over the next weekend. So,
well, my son wants to see. Or he went, and my son-in-law said, "Oh, I want to see The Grinch next." Now that you mention it, now you probably give that a bad review.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so I can't say. Okay. I haven't seen it yet, but anyway,
that's
Mary's family is angry at me. Okay, all right. Let's see. Here is we got some texts coming in, and we're talking about biopics. In fact, because of the release of. Bohemian Rhapsody. 309 area code says Lenny, the Black and White, the Smoke, and Dustin Hoffman. It's a terrific movie. Bob Fosse directed that one about Lenny Bruce, about this late stand-up Lenny Bruce. Tony, Immortal Beloved with Gary Oldman as Beethoven. Yeah, you ever see that movie?
I did not.
Nobody's seen it, really, because it didn't make a lot of money. Gary Oldman's really good in it, but I just kept calling it... I just kept calling it Raging Beethoven because it was like he was like Beethoven was like Jake LaMotta in that movie. Like he was just, so I referred to it as Raging Beethoven when it was out, when I reviewed it on the air. 773 area code, Malcolm X with Denzel Washington is a great biopic, a fantastic movie. A fantastic movie with a great performance by Denzel. 301 area code says, what about Patton and the Man with 1,000 Faces? And in the 815 area code says 12th Man. We just recently had First Man, which is out in theaters, and nobody is going to see that. And that's one of the best movies of the year, and a fantastic biopic with great performances. And that's a movie that needs to be seen if possible in IMAX. But again, it's actually one of my saddest stories of the movie year was the failure of this movie because it's just so good. It's about Neil Armstrong. It's about the first, about the moon landing and about his relationship and his family. Really strong, terrific performance by Ryan Gosling and the lovely Claire Foy. And she's got a big movie coming out Friday too. She's had she's a big year this year for her. And she's got the Dragon movie, the Dragon Tattoo, the new Dragon Tattoo movie, which looks great. The guy who directed it, this is like his first real big budget movie because he directed the Evil Dead remake and Don't Breathe. And unfortunately, I don't think Jane Levy's in the movie. I'm very upset about that. I don't think she's in the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movie. So, now I have not watched this one, but they mentioned this, My Dinner with Hervé, the HBO movie with Peter Dinklage as Hervé Villechaize. I have not watched. You know, I should watch that. It's on my the on demand. I know it's on demand because they've aired it already. And I hear it's really good. So, what else do we have here? We have Catch Me If You Can. That's a really terrific movie. DiCaprio, Hanks. That's a really entertaining movie. Although DiCaprio looks nothing like the actual dude, which you know what's the guy? I'm sorry. Every time, what's the dude's name from Napster? The guy Sean
Parker.
Sean Parker does not look like Justin Timberlake. I would have sent, if I were Sean Parker, I would have sent a lovely gift and a thank you note to David Fincher for casting Justin Timberlake as me. You know what I mean? Like, that's amazing. Well, you hold on a second. That guy, Justin Timberlake, is playing me? Wow, that's a compliment. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll wrap up the conversation about biopics right after my dad calls in and tells a joke, which will happen after this.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro.
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah. That's right. That's the familiar theme that we hear every Monday morning when my dad calls in and tells a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6 is Steve Cochran. And coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke. Let's get him on here right now. Hey, Dad.
My Nick.
How you doing?
Doing good.
How's Ma?
Mom's doing good.
Good. All right. You got a joke.
Got a joke. So Dick is introduced to an author at a party. My last book was incredibly difficult, the author said. It took me over 6 years to complete. I can sympathize, replied Dick. I'm a slow reader myself.
All right.
That's a good one. Slow reading. All right, Dad. Thanks, man.
All right, have a good day.
There you go. There's my dad telling a joke. See where he went with that one?
I do.
Not to write the book, but to read it. All right.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
That's right. And he will do it again next week. So... All right, we'll get back to the topic here at hand. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, and it is a we're talking about biopics. What are your favorite and best biopics of all time? And we've been bringing up all the other ones here. Let's see. Robert says, Invincible. Yesterday, Tom Brady played Aaron Rodgers, and they talked about how old they are. The guy in Invincible was the original old guy playing football. Yeah, that was Mark Wahlberg was in that movie, Invincible. That's a pretty good movie. 815 area code says Lincoln and I, Tonya. I, Tonya is such an entertaining movie. I really love that movie. That was one of my favorites from last year, was I, Tonya. And, of course, Allison Janney went on to win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for it. But, yeah, that's a very entertaining movie. 405 area code says The King's Speech was a good biopic. Yeah, with, why am I blanking on his name? Colin Firth. 847 area code says Jim Thorpe, All-American with Burt Lancaster. And 301 area code says A Man for All Seasons. Man for All Seasons is a tremendous movie. If you've never seen that one, you should, because it's really, really great. We also have Gandhi with Ben Kingsley. Gandhi winning all the Academy Awards that year. Let's see. We've got Ali, which starred Will Smith as Muhammad Ali. Lawrence of Arabia, That's a good one. Elizabeth with Cate Blanchett. She's great in that movie. These are just some of the other ones. JFK. Is JFK really a biopic, though? I guess it is. Brian Song, which we mentioned, which gets mentioned anytime we talk about movies that make you cry. Brian Song always pops up. Ed Wood. Oh, that's a great movie. Ed Wood, a great movie. Really, really great movie. And then that's my favorite. That's my favorite Johnny Depp performance. And just a really, really fun, really, really well done movie, Ed Wood. Let's see, The People versus Larry Flint. That's a great one. Same director, Man on the Moon, Milos Forman, who also directed Amadeus. He directed Amadeus, People versus Larry Flint, and Man on the Moon. Man on the Moon, of course, is the movie with Jim Carrey as Andy Kaufman. You've got Capote. Capote with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And The Last Emperor, which is a tremendous movie. But there's a lot of good of these biopics. Some of these are really, really great. There's Into the Wild. American Gangster with Denzel. Based on a true story. These are all real biopics. Braveheart. I remember the first time I saw Braveheart, I was, you know, this is, you know, it's like this three-hour movie that's, you know, directed by and starring Mel Gibson, and I was just like, I was kind of down on it. Like, I didn't think it was, I mean, I thought it was going to turn out like, Dances with Wolves, which I hate. I can't stand that movie. And so I thought that it was going to turn out like that. So I had real negative, I went in with a real negative attitude to Braveheart, and then I ended up loving it. Milk with Sean Penn as Harvey Milk. Chaplin, which starred Robert Downey Jr. That's another one of those movies, Chaplin, that is not at all accurate, but the lead performance by Robert Downey is great. Like Downey, Robert Downey Jr. is great in Chaplin. It's not a good movie, though, but he is really good in it. Boys Don't Cry. Boy, that's not an easy movie to watch. Hilary Swank. Great in that movie. Public Enemies. Oh, starring my friend Mike View.
He of the many vowels?
It's all of the many vowels, yeah.
A-E-I-O View.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, no, he's in Public Enemies. And said that Johnny Depp is just a very, very cool guy to work with. Let's see. Mentioned Sid Nancy and Cinderella Man. Cinderella Man is actually Cinderella Man is my favorite Ron Howard movie. Like by far, it's my favorite Ron Howard movie. And then of course we have Goodfellas, which we talked about, a little bit earlier with Joe Pesci giving the shortest accepted speech in Oscar history. Everybody was prepared for something really cool, you know. There's Joe Pesci, and he just goes up there. I am honored to have this, and then he leaves. I remember they cut to the audience like, what? Did he just really give like a 14-second Oscar acceptance speech? And you know, the producers were probably like, why can't everybody be like that? And all the people who've been sitting in the audience, well, that supporting actor is like the first category. You know, it's not like they were running late. It's like one of the first supporting actors, one of the first categories that's handed out. Or maybe, I mean, it is now. Maybe back in 1991, because that was in the beginning of 91 when they had that. Maybe they had a different order, but that's usually one of the first, if not the first category. Because didn't it? Sam Rockwell. He was the first guy up. He was the first guy up last year for Three Billboards. His birthday today, by the way. Sam Rockwell, 5-0, the big 5-0. Sam Rockwell, 50. Can you you know who else's birthday is today? No, I'm sorry. Sam Rockwell was yesterday. You know whose birthday is today? You ready for this? Ralph Macchio.
Huh.
I want you to take a guess. How old do you think Ralph Macchio is?
By the way, they do have Sam listed as today, according to the internet.
Oh, they do? Yeah. Okay, well, then, so
he and Ralph Macchio, if Sam Rockwell is 50, Ralph Macchio is...
Oh, let me guess.
You're going to guess?
Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, I think he's like my... He's got to be 60 or 61.
Ooh, okay.
Wow, I would have gone 54.
Oh, no.
He's 57.
Oh.
57. So
wait, oh, yeah. He's like, my age. I should know that.
Yeah. He's
I
a
thought
little,
he was my brother's age for some
He's
reason.
A little bit, you know, he, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have, I would have guessed late 50s because, I mean, you know, because, and he still looks like he's 15. He still looks like Daniel's son.
Oh, I know.
Oh. I don't know.
It's like Robbie Benson. They don't age.
There you go. Just gave one mention of Robbie Benson this morning. All right. We got a break here. The news is coming up next here on WGN.